All right, so as most of you know, I have children. And recently, my children have gotten to the age where they start asking questions about God, right? So it's really interesting because it never happens when you're ready for it. You can't like sit down and be like, okay, we're going to go have a theological conversation now, my seven-year-old. What theological questions do you have? Can I have a snack? You know, so... But I'll be putting them to bed or stuff like this, and they'll ask these great, deep questions like, Daddy, why doesn't everybody know about God? Or, Daddy, why did this bad thing happen to this person? And you're just like, wow, I need to, like, this, it's starting, you know? Like, my kids are starting to really delve into this stuff and ask deep questions. So I'm thinking about this, I realize that there's a couple different approaches or responses that I could have and have had with them when I'm putting them to bed or something happens and they ask, like, one of those questions. The first response is, like, panic, right? Because these are the questions, and they're big and they're hard, and so there's all this stuff on top of it. Like, how do you answer them well? How do you answer it well in terms that an 8-year-old might understand? How do you, like, are they going to not understand and they're just going to blow off this whole church thing and be done with it? So... there's all these fears that come in, so one of the responses is panic. And it struck me that when I feel that, there's really two responses I am tempted to take. One is to go into control mode, right? So to have, like, okay, here's the question, here's the answer, boom, 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 boom. It works like this, like, tight, everything makes sense. Don't worry, your questions are answered, like, real strict control. You know, I've got all the answers. Don't worry about it. There's no unanswered questions. The other extreme is to go into, like, collapse mode, right? And be like, oh my God, I don't know. That's such a big question. Let's go to bed. You know, like, just completely overwhelmed by the issue. And I've realized, or I think it's probably true that those two responses, I think, are probably what we're tempted to go to whenever we have questions, or whenever the people around us have questions, when our coworkers ask questions, when our friends, our parents, whoever it is. I think we either want to control the situation, figure everything out, have kind of this bulletproof system where everything makes sense, or we just throw up our hands and we're like, I don't know, it's just too big. I'm just not going to think about it, right? I can't deal with those types of questions. What I want to suggest tonight, and what I'd like to be kind of our guiding, I don't know, value this summer as we're exploring questions, is that there's a third route. That we don't have to be controlling, we don't have to collapse, but that we can really view questions as a chance to explore. And to demonstrate that, I want to read a quick story from 1 Kings. I might summarize some of it. So, this period of Israel's history, Solomon was king. He was crazy rich, really wise. He basically had all the answers to everything, right? So, of course, the women liked Solomon, right? So, 1 Kings chapter 10, verse 1, when the queen of Sheba heard about the fame of Solomon and his relation to the name of the Lord, she came to test him with hard questions, okay? And this, I think, is sometimes how we might feel if we encounter questions or encounter people asking us. Arriving at Jerusalem, she came with a very great caravan, yada, yada, yada. She came to Solomon and talked with him about all that she had on her mind. Solomon answered all of her questions. Nothing was too hard for the king to explain to her. So, he did what I think we want to be able to do, or maybe think we ought to be able to do. Took all these hard questions, took them in, he was super wise, and he answered them all, right? And this is what we want, right? We want for people to be able to ask us questions, and we just churn out answers. So you might think that this would have this huge impact on the Queen of Sheba, right? I mean, this is what people want. They want answers. Solomon gave her perfect answers. Solomon answered all her questions. Nothing was too hard for the king to explain to her. When the queen of Sheba saw all the wisdom of Solomon and the palace he had built, she immediately wanted to continue following the God of Israel. No. She didn't. She said, "Praise be to the Lord your God, who's delighted in you and placed you on the throne of Israel. Because of the Lord's love, he's made you king." And she gave the king a bunch of gold, a bunch of spices, and lots of precious stones. King Solomon gave her a bunch of stuff besides what he'd given her out of the bounty. Then she left and returned to her own country. End of story. Queen of Sheba's out of the picture. Right? So I think what's interesting about that is this. We think that this is what we need to be able to do. We need to be able to answer the questions, that no question is too hard for us. And yet, in this biblical story, Solomon did that, and she was like, "Wow, great answers. Have some gold. See ya." And she's gone. So, perhaps what people need aren't really answers. Perhaps having all the right answers, being able to figure out all the hard questions for others or for us, isn't really what this whole thing's about. I do a lot of premarital counseling. Some of you guys, maybe one day, or I have done. And one of the things that comes up when you're starting to get married is all of this stuff, right? So you get engaged and you're all happy for like a day. And then the work starts, right? And you got to plan a wedding, you got to make a guest list, and you got to like figure out how to please your mom or not please your mom and your Aunt Betty and whoever it is, right? And so always in premarital counseling, this stuff comes up, like, oh, this distant aunt was hurt because I didn't ask her to do the flowers, and she's always done the flowers for all my cousins, and you know, you always come up with these types of issues. And when you're getting married, it's tempting to see those things as like distractions, right? Like, I'm trying to plan a wedding here. Why are all of my family issues so difficult? Or you're trying to figure out how much money should we spend on the wedding, and you're trying to figure this out with your fiance, and you're having arguments about do we spend this much or that much, and you say, we just need to get to this wedding. This like financial thing is a distraction. It's like, I wish we could get past this. And I always try to remind couples, like, that stuff that you think is a distraction is actually the real stuff. Like, as you're planning a wedding, you're planning to be married. And the things that come up as you're married are, how do you please your mother? How do you please your father? How much role are they going to have in our kids' lives? How do we spend money? How do we save money? Those are the issues that you deal with as a couple. So the time you spend now dealing with those issues, it's not distractions from the main goal. That is the main stuff. And I tell that story to say, I think that could be helpful for us thinking about questions and our faith. Because I think sometimes we think that I want to believe, I want to just go, I want to do this Christian thing, and I wish these questions would just go away. I wish I could answer them or set them aside. I wish I just didn't have to deal with them, and I could just have this perfect strong faith and everything always made sense to me. And I think perhaps that those questions that we think are distractions might actually be the real stuff of faith. That exploring those and wrestling with them and trying to sort through that actually is what it means to have faith in God. So that's my kind of working hypothesis, and now I'm going to try and demonstrate that to you. So we're going to talk about two main ideas tonight, and my intention is to go quickly and give us some time to discuss in small groups, but my intentions to go quickly don't always pan out, so we'll see. My two big ideas, though, that we want to talk about tonight is that Christianity is about questions. Christianity is about questions. And Christianity is about, any guesses?
Answers.
Nice work. You guys know me. Christianity is about answers. So I think this holds true in a lot of stuff with faith and the way God works and the way he reveals himself to us. Is that there are often two statements that are seemingly exclusive that are both true at the same time. And that's part of what I consider the mystery and glory of this whole Christian faith thing, is that somehow those things come together. So tonight we're exploring the fact that Christianity is about answers and questions at the same time. So first, Christianity is about questions. You've probably met some Christians, maybe you think this way, maybe you've heard pastors talk this way, maybe we sound this way at times, that see the Bible as like an encyclopedia, right? And you say, I want to know about this question. And you're like, oh, perfect. Here's the answer, right? Or I have this question about what I should do with my life. Oh, there you go, right? And so for a lot of people, the Bible becomes this book of answers. And it's supposed to just answer life's questions. But what I realized in thinking through this series in the summer is that the Bible is full of questions. And I think the Bible actually, I would suggest, has more questions than answers. So I'm going to read a bunch of them. All right, this is kind of like a Bible blast. Ready for this? All right. These are good questions too, by the way. Jeremiah 47, verse 6. Sword of the Lord, you cry. How many times have you cried that? Sword of the Lord, you cry, how long until you rest? Return to your scabbard. Cease and be still. This is a cry to God to relent, to bring peace to the earth. Where's my list? Isaiah 55, 2. Why spend money on what is not bread, and your labor on what does not satisfy? It's a good question, right? Why do we run after these things that aren't actually what we need in life? Good question. Lamentations 3:39. What's going on?
There's a park right there.
Why should any living man complain when punished for his sins? Okay, good question. The Psalms are full of questions. Psalm 2, verse 1. Why do the nations conspire and the peoples plot in vain? Why is this all this fighting, all this wars in the world? Psalm 10, verse 1. Why, O Lord, do you stand far off? Why do you hide yourself in times of trouble? I think this is a question we can ask sometimes, right? If God is real, why does he seem far away? Why does he seem like he's way out there? Psalm 22, verse 1. My God, why have you forsaken me? Why are you so far from saving me, so far from the words of my groaning? Of course, Jesus asked this question as he was on the cross, and we sometimes ask it when things are going difficult for us. Jesus asked a bunch of questions while he was on the earth. He said this in Matthew 5:13. You are the salt of the earth, but if the salt loses its saltiness, how can it be made salty again? He's looking for a chemist in the room, right? How does unsalty salt become salt? I don't know. You got an answer, Michael? Abraham? No? You do a lot with salts, don't you?
Yeah.
Batteries are all about salts. He's talking to you there. Matthew 6:25. You don't usually taste your compounds? Maybe that's what you've been missing. Therefore, here we go. Matthew 6:25. Is not life more important than food and the body more important than clothes? Is it? Some people think not. Some people think life is the body. And the body, clothes, right? Life is food. Matthew 20:32. Jesus asks this. What do you want me to do for you? He asked. Jesus comes to the earth, meets a bunch of people. What do you want me to do for you? It's a big question for Jesus to ask people, right? Luke 9:25. What good is it for a man to gain the whole world and yet lose or forfeit his very self? You probably work with people that should be asked this question, right? What good is it to gain the whole world but lose your very self or your very soul, other people say. So the point is, the Bible is full of questions. Good questions. I think the Bible is probably full of the big questions that we tend to ask. And if that's the case, then perhaps those questions are meant to be something more than just answered. Perhaps it's not just about finding those answers, but there's an exploratory process. Have you ever talked to people that are really hard to talk to? You're like, yeah, you. No. Like, What makes people easy to talk to? What do you think? What makes a good conversationalist?
They listen to you.
What's that?
They listen to you.
They listen to you. Yeah, for
active
sure.
Listening.
Sorry, active listening.
Active listening. Wow. You've learned about this. What else?
They ask good questions.
They ask good questions. Yeah.
They have interesting stories.
They have interesting stories. Okay. Yeah, good conversations are this mix, right? I mean, there's like, they talk, they listen, they ask. There's this dynamism, right? It goes, starts somewhere, it moves somewhere else. You pick up on something, you ask a question, and there's kind of this flow. That's what makes good conversation. But think about it. Questions are critical for a conversation to keep going, right? If I just come and I just talk and talk and talk and talk and talk at you, you'll be like, oh, I'm going to go get a burger, right? Like, I was talking with you. But, like, if I come to you and I'm like, oh, like, tell me about your life. What's going on? What do you fear? What's your biggest hopes? What do you have for breakfast, right? Don't worry, I won't really ask those questions. But that keeps stuff going, right? It, like, continues the relationship. It continues the dynamic. And so if this whole thing, this whole Christian thing is a relationship with God, then questions are part of it. They continue the dynamic. They keep it going. So I think some people have this mindset of questions, though, that they just need to be answered. I was thinking about my job and thinking about being a pastor. And if the whole point is to answer questions, then my job would be to go off, go to seminary, collect all the answers, right? Get them all. Come here and just like dump, right? And be like, hello, I am Paul, your pastor. Bring me your questions and I will give you the answer, right? Like, that'd be it. Like, I got all the answers. I went off. I studied. You know, I got it down. Come to me. I'll set you straight. But like, that'd be really boring, right? Because the rest of my life is just like distributing information that I received. Like, that's not, I don't think, what being a pastor is about. I don't think that's what about the Christian faith is about. It's not about having the answers and distributing them. It's about this exploration process. But I think what impedes that is that we're scared of questions. We're scared of questions because we think we need the answers, or we think we have to figure it out. So what fascinates me about Jesus is that he never seems to be afraid of questions. So here's Luke 11:53. He says, "Woe to you experts in the law, because you have taken away the key to knowledge. You yourselves have not entered. You have hindered those who were entering." When Jesus left there, the Pharisees and the teachers of the law began to oppose him fiercely and to besiege him with questions, waiting to catch him in something he might say. So these people are coming to Jesus, trying to trap him, throwing question after question after question at him. And yet he's like, all right, let's talk. Right? He's not intimidated by them. He's not scared of them. He just says, okay, let's think about these questions. And I like that as a model for what we might do with our faith. So I want to use science as an example, right? Because I think that deep down, some of us fear that this whole thing is just a farce, right? This whole thing is just like, couldn't possibly be true. It's too good to be true. It's just this like system that's hanging by a thread. And we're afraid that if someone asks the right question, it'll just like poke out the last support and the whole thing will fall down, right? And so I think some of us have this deep fear that if the questions get too hard, then we're just going to give up, right? So let's think about science. I did some research, tried to go far enough back that nobody would be able to refute me. 17th century, okay? We have any molecular biologists, cellular biologists? Mostly engineers here, right? Okay, that's good. Perfect. So you know that what I'm saying is right, okay? 17th century, people started to discover cells, right? They started to figure out that plants were made from cells. Does anybody know what the first substance where cells were discovered in was?
Honey.
What?
Honey.
Honey, no.
Cork.
What?
Cork.
What is it?
Cork.
Cork, yes. See?
Good work.
Cork. So somebody's studying cork under a microscope, and they're like, hey, this looks like it's made up of cells. Now, I want you to imagine a conversation, okay? There's a scientist, and he's got some cork and a microscope, and he's in the 17th century. And he's got his buddy, and he goes, huh, this cork looks like it's made up of cells. I wonder if all living creatures are made up of cells that are tiny. What are cells called? They are the building blocks of life. I wonder if all living life is made up of little things that are the smallest form of life that are actually the building block of all life. And his buddy goes, well, that's stupid. How would they hold together? And he goes, oh, you're right. Forget it. Like, that's not the way science works, right? It's more like, I wonder if this. And somebody says, well, that's stupid. How would they hold together? And he goes, well, maybe. Huh, how would they hold together? And you go to the next thing. And then he says, well, maybe they hold together this way. And he goes, that's stupid. They can't hold together that way. And he goes, all right. So then you go to the next thing, right? This is how we go, right? So, but sometimes I think Christian discussions go like this. I believe that Jesus Christ is the unique incarnation of God in the world, that he died and then rose again so that my relationship with the creator of the universe could be restored. And somebody says, what about that kid that was born in Africa and died without hearing? And we're like, oh yeah, forget it. Never mind. It's like, oh, that question's too hard. I'm just going to drop it. Instead of like, well, yeah, what about that? And who is God? And how does he work? And what is his character? And how is he reaching the world? That's the way this thing is meant to progress. So questions don't end it. Questions don't derail faith. Questions carry us forward. They carry us into more and more exploration of who God is. So, Christianity is full of questions, but Christianity is also about
answers.
Right, okay. Now, here's the thing about funny thing about answers. Answers, I think, can either be dead-end answers, or they can be, like, next-step answers, right? And I think sometimes people... And sometimes people in Christian circles have dead-end answers. And sometimes, and I think Christians can be particularly prone to do this, is that they pretend like they're asking you a question, but they're really giving you an answer. Has this happened to you? Yes? This happened to me yesterday, actually. So it's the first time this happened to me, but I'm at the church, and I get a phone call. And you guys have heard this story. And... So at the church, all the pastors have like a half day that we're on call, which means like if somebody just shows up at the church saying, I need to talk to a pastor, then we get it. If somebody calls in like, I need to talk to a pastor, they get sent to us. So somebody called in and said, I want to talk to a pastor, so it's my turn. I answer the phone. And they said, I've got a question about the Bible. I said, all right, good. Like, I've got answers about the Bible. What's your question? And the guy asks, how can God be a Trinity if the Bible says so many places that God is one? My first thought is, wow, that's a really good question. And then I thought, who just calls in randomly to a random church to find a random pastor to ask a really good theological question? So I said, what's your background? And he started answering, he's a little dodgy. And finally I kept pressing, he said, oh, I'm a Jehovah's Witness. I said, oh. Jehovah's Witnesses randomly call churches asking randomly for pastors and asking questions. And so I've kind of replayed this whole experience in my head many times, and that was the turning point where there was like two forks in the road and I chose the dark, bad one, right? So I was like, okay, let's talk about your question. That was the wrong thing to do because this guy wasn't really asking a question. He was giving an answer in the form of a question. So as soon as I started answering his question, well, there's all this stuff in the Bible and it tries to make sense of it, and the early church, he just unloads, right? He backs the truck up and dumps all of this. How can that be? And what about this? And you don't know Hebrew and blah, 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 blah. And literally, I mean, he was screaming at me. I tried to say, like, I'm not going to have a conversation like this. And he refused to be quiet. So I just put the phone on my desk. And for like 5 minutes, I just kept working, and he's like yelling into the phone. And finally, it got quiet, and I picked it up, and he hung up. So this guy, he pretended to have a question, but all he was interested in was giving out answers, right? And I think Christians, sometimes we are like this. We think that we have these answers to disseminate to the world, to just dump on the world. But we know that that's not really nice, and so we pretend like we have questions, just to give us the door to give answers. But that's not the type of answers the Bible has, I don't think. I don't think it has the type of answers that you just get dumped on and overwhelmed by and crushed by. So I think the types of answers the Bible has are the types that lead you to the next thing. So here's an example. Exodus 3, 13 to 14. Moses asks a really good question of God. God picks Moses and he sends him out and he says, you need to go do this crazy thing for me. So Moses asks a really good question. He says, suppose I go to the Israelites and say to them, the God of your fathers has sent me to you, and they ask me, what is his name? Then what should I tell them? It's a good question, right? Like, you're sending me to do something. What if they want to know your name? What should I tell them? So God says, God said to Moses, I am who I am. This is what you are to say to the Israelites. I am has sent me to you. What kind of an answer is that? Right? He's expecting, like, I don't know, George or Bob or Larry, like, call me this. I am who I am. Tell them I am has sent me. And this is, I think, the type of answer the Bible is full of. God answers the question, but he does it in a way that makes you go, what in the world is going on? What's next? What does I am mean? Why would God claim that kind of name for himself? What does that say about the nature of God? What does that say about the nature of existence? What does that say about I, right? I mean, it's like this answer that just unfolds into more and more questions that go deeper and deeper. Here's another one, Luke 24, 1 to 8. So, you know the story. Jesus died. They put him in a tomb, closed the rock over. Some people go. Chapter 24, verse 1. On the first day of the week, very early in the morning, the women took the spices they had prepared and went to the tomb. Of course, they got there, and the tomb was open. It says this, while they were wondering about this, the fact that they did not find the body of the Lord Jesus. So they had this question, right? What happened to Jesus? While they were wondering, angels came up, and this is what they said. Why do you look for the living among the dead? He is not here. He has risen. Remember how he told you, while he was still with you in Galilee, the Son of Man must be delivered into the hands of sinful men, be crucified, and on the third day be raised again. So they have a question. What happened to Jesus' body? Now, there could be an answer like, oh, robbers came and they buried it somewhere else. If that were the answer, it'd be like, oh, okay. End of conversation, right? But instead, the answer to their question is, he's risen. He was dead, but now he's alive. Not only that, he told you this was going to happen and you don't remember, so he predicted it. And so now there's this answer to the question of a missing body that raises so many more questions. How did he get alive after not being alive? How did he know that was going to happen? Who is this guy? What does this mean about all the stuff he said over these last 3 years? There's further and further questions. And I think that's the type of answer the Bible gives. One more. Romans 6, 15 to 18. This is a really good question. A lot of people ask this. Paul's talking about law. He's talking about grace. And he makes the point that we are completely under grace, that God has forgiven us, that there is nothing we can do to lose that grace, to destroy that grace, that law has no part of us. So he asks this, what then, shall we sin because we are not under law but under grace? It's a really good question, right? This is what a lot of people ask. Well, if you're forgiven, if there's free grace, then why not do whatever I want? Well, Paul says, by no means. Don't you know that when you offer yourselves to someone to obey him as slaves, you are slaves to the one you obey, whether you are slaves to sin, which leads to death, or to obedience, which leads to righteousness. But thanks be to God that though you used to be slaves to sin, you wholeheartedly obeyed the form of teaching to which you were entrusted. You have been set free from sin and have become slaves to righteousness. And you go, oh, thanks. I don't have that question anymore, right? No. You go, what on earth is he talking about? What does it mean that I've been set free from sin? What does it mean that I'm a slave to righteousness? Don't you know? No, I don't know that. Why would I know that? What does it mean that I'm slaves to the one whom I... He opens up. He takes a good question and he answers it in a way. For a long time, this was really frustrating to me. It's like, why is he doing this? Why doesn't he just tell me? Because I think that's the point, right? Like, he opens us up to what does it mean that I'm set free from sin? What does it mean that now I'm a slave to righteousness? How does that make sense in my life? And this is the process. Good questions lead to answers that lead to more good questions. So there's been a group of guys that when we've been looking at Romans over the past year together studying it, and somebody made the comment, we kind of did a wrap up, but somebody made the comment that that I can't remember what they said. Said I have something like, I have a whole lot of answers. I feel like I understand Romans better than when I started, but I have a lot more questions than when I came in with. And I think that's a good thing, particularly for studying Romans, because you go into this and there's a lot of really cool stuff, but it's like there's questions you never thought you had until they were posed. And you never thought, what does it mean that I'm a slave to righteousness, until that answered some other question. And this is the process of faith. So, Laura, ask me an easy question. Really easy, like super easy, math. Math question.
3 plus 2.
5.
7 plus 8.
No, I said just 1.
Oh.
So Laura says, what's 3 plus 2? I say 5. And we're done. Right?
Or a sedan full of children.
What's that? A van full of children? That's true. My house, 5. 3 plus 2. Nice. Good observation. Those questions are boring. Those answers are boring, right? 5. Okay, the conversation's over. I know what 3 plus 2 is. That's not the kind of answers the Bible has. So what I'm hoping for us, not that you answered a boring question. You know, I forced you to, so it's okay. So we started off talking about my daughter, my kids, asking questions about God. And this is how I'm trying to see it with them. This is how I want us to see it with each other, with ourselves, with our coworkers, with our friends, is that these questions people ask are hard questions. They're good questions. We're going to talk about a lot of them this summer. But not because we have all the answers and we're just going to dump them, or we're going to figure them out, or you're going to have a question that you've always wondered about and come to Yaf and Paul's going to give you the answer and you'll go home and finally sleep well that night because your burning theological question has been put to rest. That's not going to happen this summer. What I'm hoping will happen is that we will explore these questions and they will bring us somewhere else, and they'll bring us into deeper thoughts about who we think God is and what we think it means to believe in Him. And I'm hoping that that means we can invite people that might be want to be a part of that process, people we know, coworkers. We've said that we want to challenge you guys to invite somebody this summer. Over the course of the summer, make it a goal to invite one person to YAF this summer. And just say, hey, we're talking about questions. We're going to be exploring them. I know that's probably terrifying, but see what happens. And the hope then is that what we do, we'll spend some time like this talking, and then we'll go into small groups and we'll explore this together. So that's what we're going to do now. Got about maybe 20, 25 minutes to do that. But I want to give some guidelines for these small groups, and I'll repeat these throughout the summer. So first of all, you don't have to agree with me. Okay, that's the first rule. Like, just because I said it doesn't mean it's true. I know that comes as a great shock to many of you, especially Liz. I mean, she's just been shattered her world. But like, I don't know about you guys, but I've learned a lot of, like, some of the, I think, most powerful stuff I've learned is when I've listened to people speaking and been like, oh yeah, I don't think the way he does. So that's okay, right? You can hear what I say and you can say, no, that doesn't make sense to me. In fact, maybe it's something else. That's the first thing. It's okay to disagree with anybody, me, each other, whatever. Second thing is, as we're talking about this and as we're talking about questions, we want to try, and as we listen to each other, this one's really important, we want to try and give answers that aren't like 5. We want to try and give answers that are more like, I am who I am. Okay? So you're in your small groups and we're talking and somebody says, yeah, why do bad things happen? And you're like, oh, it's because boom, 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 boom. And everything's dead, right? That's not the type of discussion we want to have. We want to have the discussion that's like, Yeah, I've had that question too. Here's something that makes sense to me, but that makes me think this. What about that? Those types of things, okay? So we don't want to just kind of like whatever book you've read or pastor you've heard or anything just dump on each other. We want to be exploring this together. And I had a third thing, but I'm forgetting it. Third thing is, we're asking these questions in the context of faith. And so if there are people in your group that aren't coming from a context of faith, if skeptics or unbelievers or whatever, if you're wondering about your faith, that's okay. It's okay where you are, but the questions we're asking are, if God were real, then what? If this is true, what could that mean? And so we're kind of doing a scientific hypothesis. So what that does is, no matter where you are in your faith, if you're solid or you're wondering or you used to believe or you might think you believe or whatever, we're trying to say, if this faith thing is real, then what could this mean? Doesn't mean you think it's real, but it's a starting point to open up the discussion. Okay? So you don't have to agree with me. Answers like, I am who I am, not like five. And starting from a context of faith. So for tonight, we're going to...